What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Wonder Podcast, the podcast where we give a breakdown and a critique of films all in one take. I'm Austin Archer, and with me, as always, is my childhood next-door neighbor and lifelong best friend,
Kramer England.
What's up, dude?
What's up?
We're doing a double header tonight. I don't
we
know if
are.
The audience is going to watch these as separate episodes, but we're going to just boom, boom.
Yep.
Wicked and Gladiator 2, because it was a big weekend in the box office.
It was a big weekend.
Yeah.
Not as big as Barbenheimer.
Right.
But Glicked, is that how they're pronouncing it?
Wickiator?
I like that one better.
Wickedator? Wickedator.
Yeah. Whatever you want to call it.
Are they saying Glicked?
That's what I keep seeing. It looks like Glicked. But it's got to be Glicked, right? Because it's like Gladiator and Wicked, Glicked. I don't know.
You know,
Barbenheimer just works way better.
Barbenheimer is great. I think Wickedator is pretty cool.
Wickedator, that could be good. Yeah.
Wickedator.
Yeah, let's start that one.
Wickedator.
Wickedator.
We're starting off with John M. Chu's adaptation of the massive international hit musical Wicked, based on the book by, I should have looked this up, the 1995 novel. That is an adaptation of, you know, a take on
five novel. Yeah.
Yeah. The Wizard of Oz, which is a movie, which is based on a book. So it's
Gregory Maguire. I think that's who wrote it.
Sure. Why not? And I think that this is like the originator of, is that right? Gregory Maguire.
Gregory Maguire is the novel. Yes.
I think this is like one of the first times in the modern era of, IP storytelling, where we did this thing of like, what if we reimagine or re-envision the origin story of a classic villain?
Yeah. Yeah. Right? I feel like this book kind of, we'd have to look, but I feel like this is kind of the beginning of all of those. And then you had Disney, kind of follow suit with a lot of their remakes of movies from different perspectives.
Yeah, Maleficent comes to mind, just the kind of ways that we like to go back and revisit this IP and go, what if we can flesh out the villain a little bit more to humanize them? And this movie, or at least the music, I've never read the book, I'll be completely honest, obviously.
I have not either, yeah.
But I've been we graduated high school in 2006. I was a musical theater kid in high school. Mm-hmm. Wicked was the musical. It came out on Broadway in 2003, and this soundtrack was huge. And it's sort of like, it's been for the last 20 plus years kind of one of the shows to see on Broadway. People go to Broadway and they're like, oh, I gotta see, if Les Mis is playing, you try to see that. If Lion King is still there, I think it still is, people try to see that. And one of those staple shows that has been running forever is Wicked.
And have you seen it on Broadway?
I saw it on Broadway when we were in high school, and I saw it also in Chicago on a choir trip to Chicago. So I saw
Very cool.
I saw it on stage twice. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have. I've actually seen it on Broadway twice.
Yeah.
We went for Thanksgiving one year, early 2000s, and saw it there. And then me and my wife went in 2009 and saw it there. So it was great. I mean, it's a great play.
Yeah, and it's, Stephen Schwartz wrote some absolute bangers. We did not do a little pre-roll before we got into this, so neither one of us know how the other one feels about the two movies we're talking about today.
Yes.
I'm going to say right out of the gate here, I think Wicked rules. I think John M. Chu crushed this movie. I think Ariana and Cynthia just dominate this movie. That's the most important roles in the film, obviously. They're on every single poster, and they're having this really kind of like talked about press tour. But I think that, the person I went and saw it with looked at me at the end of the movie and was like, I don't know that they could do it much better than that. And I was like, I kind of tend to agree. I don't know that you can adapt that stage musical much better. What do you think? What are your thoughts on Wicked?
Well, it was amazing.
Okay.
It was amazing. Yeah. I'm sorry. I tried. It was so good. I totally agree with whoever you saw that with. I don't know if they could do that good. Every musical number, I saw it with my family. I took my wife and my kids. It's a long movie. They all sat through it. They all loved it. My two boys loved it. My two girls loved it. It's a great, fun movie. It's not without its weaknesses, but it was this is the movie that's just so much fun to watch. Yeah. Like, I want to go to a sing-along just to see how that energy is and to see, like, people included, you know, like, in the singing. I think that would be fun, but...
I got invited to a really cool sing-along last night that I didn't go to because I went to Gladiator 2 instead.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
It was Kristen Bell was there. And my friend was like, she's like, hey, me and Kristen Bell are doing this sing-along at a private screening on the Universal lot if you want to come to it. And I was like, I'm going to Gladiator 2 and I have to see it so I can talk about it on my podcast.
Oh, no. So. We could have done something. I feel so bad. That would have been fun.
No, you know, I was like, that's not the time that I want to be bothering Kristen Bell is at this.
That's true. That's true.
Absolutely. It's I will say right now, listen, I was a huge fan of this musical growing up. And as a musical theater kid, this was a soundtrack that I really liked listening to and singing in the car and sort of. But I will say both times I saw this, both in Chicago and in New York, it was a little underwhelming. And I felt like the musical that I saw in my head when I would listen to the soundtrack was more epic than what it wound up being on stage. Not that the stage production isn't great. It's got amazing scenic design. The cast is always incredible. Fantastic choreography, beautiful costume design.
Yeah.
Really well staged. And again, like about as good as you can do on a Broadway budget.
Right.
It's just like there is a inherent grandiosity to this concept, to the story being told in this musical. And some of the biggest moments of this musical, you know, namely like the big one, Defying Gravity, the Act One finale. Yeah. And when you just listen to the soundtrack and you're imagining what it's like that she's taking off and she's flying with her broom, and then you go see it and it's like in the moment it's really powerful, her lifting off the stage and they have this light behind her, but then she sort of just spends the entire rest of the song suspended in that same position for like 2 minutes straight because they can't really do much else on stage other than just have her in that position while she sings. Totally. And it's sort of an inherently cinematic moment. Like it's a moment that is begging to be given the big screen treatment.
Yeah.
And this movie does not disappoint at all with the way that it translates that moment and many similar moments to it, to the big screen. And it's like for the first time in my life, the thing that I was seeing in my head it was matched by the visual, you know, like, and the music hit so hard in a theater. That's the other thing is sometimes seeing live musical theater, the sound doesn't hit as hard as you want it to because it's a live, it's a bunch of actors singing live with a live orchestra. And the sound in a theater sometimes doesn't really like get inside your sternum or your chest the way that you want it to. Both times I saw it, I was pretty far back and the sound was like, the picture was small and the sound wasn't really hitting me. I was like, man, I can turn this up in my car and really rock out to these songs. And seeing it live, it wasn't getting in there. Seeing it with like Dolby sound in a movie theater with a movie score that is thundering through your body is like, it's so powerful. And giving those songs really that sonic treatment.
It's interesting that you say that. So when I saw it both times, the first time I saw it, it was pretty early on. This was probably 2005 that I saw it, maybe 2004, 2005. What's her name was not, she had already gone. Adina Menzel had already gone. Adele Dazeem had already gone. Thank you, John Travolta. Tom Travolta, whatever you want. Yeah.
Adele Dazeem.
That was so weird.
Yeah.
She had already gone. And I don't know how many people had come after her, but the woman that I saw, it's like, and it's probably because I didn't really listen to it. Right. I didn't listen to the soundtrack or anything like that before. I think I had heard the song and I was like, wow, that's really good. Like Defying Gravity, but I didn't really hear anything else. And so I went and saw it and this girl killed it. Like, in my mind, she's better than Adina Menzel. Like, and it could just be because I saw it first. Like, that is my first experience with this soundtrack and everything. Like, she was amazing. And so for me, my experience, and then the second time I saw it, it wasn't as good, but it was still great. The woman who did it was also great. But the first time I saw it, I was blown away. So my experience was a little bit different than yours in that I loved it because it was more of a new experience. But you having kind of had something in your head, I can see how it wasn't as good.
Well, and also, like, I think that a lot of, like, musical theater nerds and musical theater aficionados would agree that Idina Menzel is not the best Elphaba to ever do it. And she's the original. And there's always a special place for the original. There's always, like, everybody's work is based on the original. Everybody's work is crafted on what the first person did and sort of a take on that, especially in a Broadway show, because actors aren't really allowed to come in and reinvent the role for themselves. They have to fit into the same blocking, the same staging, the same, like the show that is playing on Broadway right now is the same staging and direction as the show that you saw in 2004.
Very interesting.
It hasn't been reinvented, or, you know, they haven't come in and, you know, reworked the design elements, or, you know, re-envisioned it. It's still the same product. So every actor that gets plugged in has to sort of, they can do their own little iterations of things, but really it's like, you're still like, you're filling in the Kristen Chenoweth gap in this show. Yeah. You're filling in the Idina Menzel gap. And what this is the first iteration of this show, that is the first new iteration of this material since 2003.
But like you're saying, like they use the form, this movie, they use the form of a film so much to their advantage. Like, there's something about seeing a show live. It's great. You can't get that experience, which is great because it's your own experience for that night, for that audience, right? Like that, you can't have that with movies. But this, the what they made with this movie and using the advantages of movies with close-ups and having a score, the close-ups for me is what really told the story a lot better, because you could see reactions. You can see somebody, they point the camera at Elphaba when she is reacting to something, or they point the camera at Glinda when she's and the fact it didn't just look like, there are some musicals where they just set the camera up and they just kind of show everything. And it's like, well, why didn't I just watch that? Like, on Broadway, like, I would rather just go see it on Broadway. Whereas this, they're moving the camera in a great way. They're adding so much to it that made it just so much more immersive. Yeah. And like so much. So it's taking this amazing play and making it into this amazing musical movie. Right. Yeah. And they did such a, like, John M. Chu, he killed it on this. He did awesome.
Now, I think, you know, without this sort of sounds like a hyperbolic soundbite from someone who's trying to cover the movies on the internet or something, but I do think that it's not too early to put this into the pantheon of, like, greatest stage to film adaptations of a musical ever made. There's not too many that are that, like, a lot of times this falls flat and doesn't work out, especially in the modern era. It's been a particularly difficult thing to do. It seems like it used to be a staple of Hollywood back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, doing stage to film adaptations. And sometimes movie musicals would just originate as a movie musical first and then go to the stage. It was a much more common form that people, in, you know, some of the most classic movies of all time, Singing in the Rain and West Side Story, and other, the film version that Sound of Music. It's the film version that kind of sticks in everybody, in the cultural consciousness. In the modern era, it's been like Chicago and maybe a couple others that really
worked. I'm trying to think of some.
Yeah. And there are certain things that I think make it hard in the modern era to do it like we used to. And also, it's like, structurally, the way that we write musicals in the modern era, and then, you know, 90s pluses with these massive act one finales. And this is something that Stephen Sondheim, I think, kind of started to really build into the consciousness of people who write musicals, is this idea that, like, act one and act two are very different things. And act one has its own ending and has its own sense of finality. And act two comes back and it recontextualizes everything that happened in act one, that there should be some kind of difference. And so, like, you know, one of my favorite act breaks in musical theater history is Into the Woods. And what happens in the stage play is all of these grim fairy tales that you're following Cinderella and Jack and the Beanstalk and Little Red Riding Hood. They all find their natural end point, like the happily ever after point, the end point. And that's the end of act one. So the audience goes to intermission like, okay, well, that they're all over. So what's act two? And then act two, you come back and it's like, okay, have you ever wondered what happens after happily ever after? And then act two is everything that happens after all of these characters got what they thought they wanted. And it goes into, it becomes this amazing commentary on life and on the difference between, you know, parables and myth and real life and what, you know, the consequences that people have to deal with in real life. And it's like this, it's this amazing transition. And when they do it in the movie, the I like this movie. I like Into the Woods. It's not my favorite movie musical adaptation, but I like it. I like aspects of it. Problem is, without the intermission, this midpoint happens and then the movie just keeps going and it doesn't have nearly the same impact as it does in the stage musical. And musicals have continued this tradition of sort of building a really epic act one finale that feels like that's the end of that part of the story. And now you take a break and come back for part two. And so the big kind of thing that I'm getting to, obviously, here, the big elephant in the room with Wicked is that it's Wicked part one. It's act one of the stage musical. This was a controversial choice because people thought this was just another Hollywood cash grab, where they're just needlessly extending a movie that could easily be one movie and they're just trying to get more money out of people. I think that this is the best decision they made for this movie adaptation because I don't think the movie would work as well if they didn't take the time that they took to slow the storytelling down and let the act one finale be the end of that movie and just say, you know,
I totally agree. Like, so, you know, in talking with people, a lot of them were like, I didn't even know this was a part one.
And
I did, but I didn't know Dune was a part one. So like, it just happens, you know, whichever. And when they said it was going to be a part one, I was like, oh, okay, we'll just end with Defying Gravity. Like they did, you know, the act one finale. Like, that's a good idea. Like I have no problem with that. And I totally agree. And not really knowing the structure of musical theater, what you just said makes perfect sense. Like thinking back on Wicked now on as a play, it's like, oh yeah, there's a huge difference. Like there's a big tonal shift in act one compared to act two. And so this is really like, it's a natural ending point because that's where it is. Like it makes sense. It'll be really interesting to see what they do with part two.
Like, can you imagine the movie trying to go on for another hour after the way that this movie ends?
No.
I mean, it is one of the most spectacularly climactic endings to a movie I've ever seen.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like I cried in the movie theater.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was right there too. Yeah.
Not because I was like emotional about or like sad or anything like that. It was so forceful.
Yeah.
It was such a like burst of energy coming off the screen that it kind of knocked the wind out of me when the credits hit and it rolled. I was like, yeah, there's no way I could watch another hour to an hour and a half of a movie after that. Like,
I totally cried too. It was like, it's just when a movie does something so well, and when everything hits, like the song, and I mean, we already knew the song and I knew the song. I it would be interesting to see if someone who had never seen it before felt the same way. But I can also, even if they didn't cry, like you have to feel something for that. And like, for me, it was like, this is just, everything is so well made. Like the storytelling is coming together. It's a perfect payoff. Like it all worked really, really well. So yeah, I cried too. Cause it was like, this is just done so well. Like it was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mark Maron talks about this sometimes where he goes, just hearing people sing really well will bring me to tears. And he's I don't know what it is. It's just something about that. It just like gets inside of me in a way.
Yeah.
And there's something about Cynthia Erivo's power in that finale that gets, that just shakes me to my core in the best way, in the most delightful way. And I don't want the movie to continue after that. It's like, hey,
I'm glad it stopped. Yeah.
The end. Like that's like, and we will come back for more later.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't know how they're going to top it with part two.
Yeah. I hope, you know, I am wondering this too. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, honestly, if part two is an hour and a half long, that's totally fine. My expectations are going to be, I'm going to have no expectations with part two, because it's not going to be part one. Like, I know that it's different. So, but it, you know, if they want to kind of keep it a little more toned down or something, that might be fine. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what they do. I'm very excited.
Yeah. Here's the thing is everyone was sort of, if you haven't seen the film yet, you know, we're going to talk about spoilers. We're going to talk about plot details. So spoiler warning. Yeah. If you have seen the film, a lot of people were going in wondering, what are they going to add to this movie to make act one of Wicked 2 hours and 40 minutes long? How much could they possibly add? The experience of watching the film, it doesn't actually feel like they're adding that much stuff. The word for this film that makes it not only one of the best stage to film adaptations I've ever seen, but also a movie that I think improves upon its source material, the word is pacing. And I think that in modern film criticism and modern film analysis and like, you know, film discourse and theory, people have this idea about pacing, which is that good pacing means faster and shorter, means get through the moments quicker and trim whatever you can trim and make the movie shorter. That a fewer minutes in your runtime equals good pacing, and too many minutes equals bad pacing. Right. And that's not what pacing is. Like, a 90-minute movie can be paced poorly, and a three-hour movie can be paced very well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this movie is paced so much better than the stage musical because they have the ability to do that. Yeah. And the stage musical is as popular as it is, as much of an international sensation as it is, it's the musical moves fast.
It's quick.
Because
it's
has quick. To. And it's delivering so much information so quickly that certain characters like Nessa and Dr. Dillamond and, like, you know, these storylines kind of just get like blown by so quickly that you almost miss them if you're not paying attention. This movie doesn't add a whole bunch of unnecessary stuff. It just is aware that it can take its time with some of these beats, with like, we can let a moment here breathe between these two characters and we can let this take a little longer. Even the tempo of the musical numbers slows down and they don't feel the need to push everything so fast. And like you were saying, with close-ups and everything, it just it winds up feeling like a better paced version of the stage musical.
I totally get what you're saying. There are movies that pacing is a huge part. The movie that comes to my mind is Gran Turismo, which is really funny because that movie was quick. It moved so quickly, but the whole movie was paced that way, so it was paced very well. Like they spent the time that they needed. Now, I know that's a little bit of a weird tangent, but this movie, they did do a lot more with pacing. Now, my one criticism of the movie, probably my biggest criticism, is I agree that it was paced way better than the musical, than the Broadway, but I feel like it was paced a little slow. I mean, it is long. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes. And there were definitely parts where I was like, okay, you could kind of trim this up a little bit. And then even funny enough, when they get to Oz and they meet the wizard, then it's paced very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, okay, you could have taken out a little bit from the beginning and given a little bit more to the end. But that's more of a nitpick. Like, it's not like I'm going to completely destroy the movie because of that. I think it could have been different. It could have been a little bit quicker because it's long, but I still enjoyed it. I still loved it. And I agree, like, giving those characters time to have those moments is what made the movie great.
Yeah.
Like, those interactions between Elphaba and Glinda were what made the movie how good it is.
Yep. So getting into just a few plot details of this movie, we'll try to do a quick kind of recap of the film. If it's Wicked, you know what Wicked is, you know the order of the songs, and you know all the lyrics by heart. The musical opens with it's the end of the where Wizard of Oz leaves off.
Yeah.
The Wicked Witch of the West is dead. She's been melted by the water, by Dorothy and her pals, and the people in Munchkinland are celebrating. And I really loved this sequence in the movie and how much more brutal it was to know from the start, like, this is the fate of our main character.
Yeah.
And to be reminded of that, and also immediately with Ariana Grande showing up as Glinda and doing what she does, we got to see the acting chops on Ariana Grande. This was kind of the big question, is everyone's like, we know that she's a pop star. We know she can sing. Can she act? And pretty much right out of the gate, we see some really wonderful, subtle work from her where she's kind of towing this line between the performative, you know, nature of Glinda the Good Witch and also this person who has a real deep, rich emotional history with this, the person that everybody's celebrating the death of.
Yeah. Yeah. It, and this scene was really good because knowing the end, like I know what's going on, and she did do a good job. She cut, you know, she's towing the line between funny and serious, and she's doing it really, actually really well. She was a lot more subdued than I thought she could have been. She could have been, you know, I mean, Kristen Chenoweth, she's great. Just how she pulls it all off. Like she, you know, she is very, she is a little bit more, she pushes it a little bit more, and Ariana Grande kind of pulls it back just a little bit. I felt like she could have done a little bit more, but she actually, I was very surprised with her. I wasn't surprised with Cynthia because she did great. I knew she was going to kind of play the character like that. So she did a great job. Ariana Grande also did great. And the fact that, I mean, it sounds like they're extremely good friends in real life too. That chemistry really played throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, they're definitely having, there's a whole online discourse about how strange they are being in interviews, that they're just like always holding hands and always crying. And it's very musical theater kid, I gotta say. Like musical theater people, when they do a musical together, they get really emotional about it. And they, it's like this happens with musicals. People are like, I don't know how I'm gonna let go of this show. Like it's just something that happens. I think it's when you get music involved and people sing together, people get emotional.
So
we go, they ask Glinda, oh yeah, weren't you friends with her? And she starts giving us the backstory. I did like this addition again with the movie being longer. I liked that they showed us that they do show this in the stage version, that she's brought into the world by animals, that there are animals who are helping with the delivery at her birth. But I like that they gave us a little bit more, that she had this caretaker growing up who was a bear. And I think that this helps us tap into, you know, Elphaba's relation with the animals and what's happening to them, and Elphaba's own experience with otherness, that the animals, you know, who are being sort of marginalized and oppressed by the wizard, she feels a connection to them, not only because one of the only people who was kind to her growing up is this bear that helped raise her, but also because she is othered by her green skin.
Right. Yeah. And they did a great job. I like, actually, because in a musical, it's just people who are dressed like animals. So you think, at least in my mind, when I was thinking how this movie would play out, I was thinking that the animals would be more anthropomorphized, however you say that, right? It's I was thinking they would just be people in costumes, or they would be look like animals who can walk on their hind legs. But they actually made them just animals who could talk.
Yeah.
And I was taken out of that just a little bit, but I actually like how they did that, because it does make it, I don't know, I was like, oh, that's a good idea. Like, yeah, that should be, it should just be animals who talk. And so that was really interesting. But yeah, giving her the reason to why she loves those animals and why she's fighting for animals, really set up a really good relationship and a good theme for her, and kind of giving her a little bit more depth.
And it's something that they can add without needing to do a 10-minute long scene about it. It's, this is what I'm saying. Like, they add all these little details that don't in the moment feel like, oh man, they're really padding the runtime of this movie to make it a 2.5 hour long movie. I get what you're saying, that there are maybe moments early on in the first couple acts where maybe you could have sped the pace up and moved along quicker, but it never felt to me like they were putting stuff in just for the sake of, you know, trying to figure out how to turn this into two movies. You know, like when I watch Peter Jackson's Hobbit trilogy, I am constantly like, there is so much in these movies that doesn't need to be here.
Should have been no more than two movies, for sure. Yes, I agree.
I don't even think it should have been. I think it could have easily been one movie.
You could have for sure gotten one. Yep.
My favorite is how the second movie ends with this big cliffhanger of like Smaug getting out and going to that town and being, and then like the movie ends like, what's going to happen? And the next movie starts, and within like 2 minutes they kill Smaug, and it's like, that's what happened. And it's,
I was like, why didn't you just have that as the end of the first, of the second movie? Like, that makes no sense.
But they got to do a cliffhanger. They got to be like, what will happen? And then the next movie's like, well, now we're going to do this battle. And it just feels like those movies are so stuffed with filler, where the screenplay is trying to. And I didn't get that feeling during Wicked at all.
No, I didn't either.
we go to school at Shiz University, great name. And you know, it's everything that, you know, it's like Glinda shows up. She's the most popular kid at school. I really liked Bo and Yang and Bronwyn. I can't remember her last name, Bronwyn James, as they have small parts, but I thought Bo did a nice job. I was like, I'm a big fan of Bo and Yang and his podcast, Las Culturistas. I listen to that show all the time. And I was very proud of him during, the dancing sequences, watching him dance. I was like, he's doing it. He's dancing. Nice. So I was proud of Bowen.
They were great. The small parts, but they stood out.
And obviously, there's the whole thing where Elphaba's not supposed to be going to Shiz, but her father tells her, I want you to go and keep an eye on your sister, Nessa. Yeah. And her dad likes Nessa. He doesn't like Elphaba. And Elphaba, and it, you know, there's this moment where she does something magic and Michelle Yeoh sees her and decides to take her under her wing. And
well, and even I guess going back to the dad, you know, it's not really his daughter. I don't think he doesn't know that that's not his daughter, but it is, you know, the mom, you see the mom at the beginning, she has an affair.
Yeah.
She drinks this green liquid. Right. Anyway, I don't think that's the reason that he doesn't like her, but the reason that is she's green. So he probably suspects something. But because that will come into play later on, at least in part two.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler for part two.
Yeah.
But the moment when her magic, and this is another thing that the movie can kind of do a little bit better. The magic that is shown is way more like intense.
Yeah.
Right. Like all the stuff lifts in the air and everybody kind of moves back and all this stuff starts cracking and crumbling. Mm-hmm. And it made it just like that. It immerses you more into the world because it shows how powerful she actually is.
I also really liked that they went deeper into the relationship between Madame Maribel and Glinda, that Glinda's like really trying hard to be in the sorcery program, and Madame Maribel doesn't like Glinda at all.
Yeah.
And that whole, I don't really get that aspect as strongly from the stage version, but it makes sense that then Madame Maribel almost volunteers Glinda to be Elphaba's roommate. Glinda's supposed to have her own room, a private suite. And she's like, you know what? You get to be her roommate since you're telling everyone how nice you are and how great you are. And I liked that dynamic between Michelle Yeoh and Ariana Grande was solid for some.
Well, and then it made it even better in the end when, skipping forward to the end just a little bit, when Madame Maribel is when she basically, she's never liked her the whole movie, but then when Elphaba decides she's not going to do it, she sees this opportunity to be like, oh, Glinda, this is what she's always wanted.
Yeah.
So she does kind of almost turn her to the dark side in a way, and it worked. That relationship paid off so much more in the movie because of this setup that they had at the beginning too.
I will say this. I was this way, and maybe I probably need to read the book, but I'm this way in the stage musical, and I'm still this way in the movie. I'm still unclear about whether or not Madame Maribel has any magical powers.
I am too. Yeah. I can't remember. I mean, she does the stuff with the weather.
Well, the weather. And I was like, if that's just like a trick, that's a pretty impressive trick.
My thought even from the stage play is that she has some sort of magic, but it's very limited.
Yeah.
And it's very like, cause I mean, the wizard is obviously trying. I mean, he does. Magic is real in this world. So there's something, I kind of feel like she's making it seem like she's way more powerful than she actually is, but she has a little bit.
And that is an aspect from both the stage musical and this one that I'm not sure is as clear as it could be. You know, I could use some clarity on like, how powerful is she? It seems like she's not powerful enough to use the Grimmery to do spells and at least that.
Yeah.
But she definitely sees what she's been looking for in Elphaba, the potential to for someone who actually can do real sorcery and real magic. Yeah. So she sort of takes her under her wing. We also are introduced to Dr. Dillamond, played by Peter Dinklage.
Great job.
He does a nice job here. And we're sort of introduced to this concept of like, there's something happening between the animal world in Oz, the animals and the people sort of coexist, but for some reason animals are being put away, and there's sort of this kind of like xenophobic attitude toward the animal world where people start wanting animals to not speak anymore and not be in positions of power. I also like this detail in the movie that when Elphaba first does her magic, the seal that has the wizard, the seal at Shiz University that's like a mural of the wizard, breaks. And when it falls down behind it, we see a mural of a bunch of animals that look like the founders of the university, like before. Yes. And there's also, there's no animal students. It's only human students. And there's one animal teacher. So we're getting an idea of world building of like, there used to be more animal and human intermingling, and it's becoming more and more rare for that to happen.
Yeah. And Dr. Dillamond as well. I mean, the fact that he's the only one, and also in the musical, I don't want to say he was played for laughs, but it was hard that, I don't know, it was harder to connect with him like in the musical, but in this movie, making him an actual animal and the way that Peter Dinklage voices the character gives him a lot more like I'm like, man, this is like serious. Like it just seemed to be taken a little bit more serious, and it gives it a lot more stakes, you know, like this is something real.
It's a tough character to get right in the stage musical. And again, there's only ever been one iteration of this done, but he has very limited stage time, and because of the makeup he's wearing, and because of the fact that his speaking voice is devolving back into that of just like a goat, and just, it almost feels like it's played for laughs, but it's not supposed to be funny. Like he is losing his ability to speak. And you're right. In the movie, we can see that emotional weight on the character's face more, and we feel it, you know, with when he turns his chalkboard around and it says animals should be seen, not heard. Glinda and Elphaba are roommates, and they do our first big musical number of the movie. Our first big musical number is that opening, No One Mourns the Wicked, which is a banger in the movie. Really introduces us to the world of the movie with a bang. But what is this feeling, or you know, loathing,
fun.
I really liked the staging of, I loved the choreography.
Yep.
This is the dance in movie musicals, especially modern movie musicals, is you talked about close-ups. When do you choose to punch in and give a reaction shot versus when do you go wide and give us what we want to see with big production numbers, which is the dance. And I think that John M. Shu, in both In the Heights and here, does a nice job of negotiating that dance in the camera and not cutting too often to where I can't tell what's going on in the choreography and letting me see the bigger picture. For my money, when it comes to musicals on film, I would always like more wide shots of the choreography than less. As many as you can give me, I will take. And in fact, my preference will always be from a technical standpoint that like, if it's a big group musical number and everybody's dancing, the camera should barely ever cut. It should be a big wide shot of that thing. And you can get, you know, close-ups here and there for solos, but like, I want a big master of that as much as possible. I think they do a pretty darn good job, but like, one thing from the golden age of movie musicals is everything was in big wides. If you go watch West Side Story, if you go watch Singin' in the Rain, everything is just a big wide master the entire time. And that's my personal preference, but I think that they do a nice job here.
Yeah, I think they do. And then, I mean, I can't remember exactly. I mean, they definitely hate each other. Galinda and Elphaba do not like each other. And then Fiero comes in, and I've got to say, Fiero was not very good the first two times I saw him. I've never seen a really good Fiero. The actor who played this is by far the best version of Fiero that I have seen. I really enjoyed the character. I really like this actor from Bridgerton. I should know his name.
John Bailey, I think.
John Bailey, yes. Yeah. He did a great job. I think he's great in Bridgerton. He brings that airiness that Fiero is supposed to have, which is that he doesn't really care. And he kind of, you know, people are teaching us the wrong lessons. But then
he's
like
dancing through life, baby.
And this song, Dancing Through Life. This was probably my favorite number choreography wise. The thing that they did with the rolling,
The production design. Library?
Yes.
The production design here is amazing. This library set. First, we gotta talk about how many practical sets are in this movie that look amazing.
I love that they did that. Like it makes it feel so much more tangible.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and they have this, like, you know, the set to the school where they come in on the boats and like you could see that is all real. Like, I'm sure they had set extensions and everything, but it's like, wow, that looks beautiful. Like it's, and then this musical number, they're rolling and the dance choreography, and they have those ladders that are kind of going in and you don't really know which way is up and down
because
the camera kind of moves and tilts.
Yeah.
Like this was probably the funnest musical number that they had. And I was so happy that it was such a good rendition. I don't know if that's actually him singing or if they had somebody else for him sing.
No, that's him. Yeah, so not only is it him singing, but also much like Tom Hooper's Les Miserables movie adaptation, this movie has mostly live singing in the mix. So most of our characters are singing live on set. They were singing live on the sound stages that they were shooting on, and they recorded vocals live. And so most of what we're getting is a live performance from these actors, and it's fantastic. Like
it is.
It's incredible, and everybody sounds great. And obviously in a movie, they're going to go through and they're going to like pitch correct if anybody's off on a note, or they're going to make sure that everything is like pristine. They're going to make sure that we get the best possible take, and they're, you know, but it sounds great. And you're right. The staging here is great. I have a question for you about the, one of the major things that people are roasting this movie for is the color grading. And we've got these amazing sets, but everybody is making fun of the movie for the lighting and the color grading, saying that the color grading is too washed out and that the lighting has too many lens flares to see anything clearly. How did you feel about that?
I don't agree, because I thought, I mean, sometimes, I mean, it's great to have a really bright color palette, but I didn't think it was washed out. And I don't know, maybe it's just me. Like, I loved it. I thought it wasn't over the top, because sometimes when you really saturate the colors, you can make it feel, it feels less tangible. It also feels more fake and more plastic. I thought the colors popped really, really well. I really enjoyed it. And I heard that critique and I'm like, that's weird. I don't agree with it. So,
you know, what's interesting is when people show me, when I see clips online, when people show little clips on like TikTok or YouTube, when they're making fun of the color grading or criticizing the color grading, I look at it and go, oh, I see what you're talking about. Yeah. It's a little drowned out. It's a little like it looks a little, it could be a little brighter, but in the theater, I didn't think about it once. I wasn't sitting in the theater going, oh geez, I wish this wasn't so washed out. I felt like in the theater, it was popping off the screen. It was it was vibrant. It was beautiful. I could see everything. So my experience of like seeing the film, I wasn't sitting there going, oh man, I wish the colors were more radiant. It almost feels like when I'm looking at it on a little computer screen or something, it's worse, which I guess that's cinema, you know?
Yeah. But, and also, it's, I did not notice it once until after the movie when I saw a headline that said, John M. Chu reacts to color grading. And I'm like, what's wrong with the color grading? So
people were going in on the, I think people are making way too much of it. I can see it. I can see the argument for like, hey, this is the Wizard of Oz here that we're doing. This is like the original Technicolor film. We got to honor it with, you know, we got to honor it with a very vibrant color palette. I get it. I get the argument, but I think that the way people are talking about it, like it's a very ugly film. And I didn't get that at all.
I didn't get it either.
Gorgeous costume designs, gorgeous production design. Yeah. And I think that it all shows up on.
Oh yeah. And I, it's not like, you know, Man of Steel where they like really desaturated everything to make his suit pop. Like it's not like that at all. I thought it is very much more naturalistic. So it's not really like, it's not like they went crazy, but I thought it popped. I had no problem with it. So I just disagree with people who had a problem with it. Not that they are wrong, but it didn't bother me.
Dancing Through Life also has one of my favorite moments where they took advantage of the opportunity to slow the pacing down.
Yeah.
And this is something that, it could really not work if it's not handled well. Yeah. And I think that they handled it really well. This whole moment where, Elphaba shows up to the Oz Dust ballroom wearing this silly hat that Glinda gave her to make fun of her. And it's kind of a mean girl's moment where she tricked her into wearing this ugly hat. And you sort of have to suspend your disbelief that like everybody's dressed weird. It's Oz. Everybody's wearing weird clothes. Yeah. Why are they singling out this girl for her weird clothes? But they do a nice job with the costume design of showing how she's different. That even though everybody's wearing odd clothes and Oz clothes, they're all in a certain color palette and a certain vibe. And she comes in and it's all black and her green skin. And she's very clearly different from everybody in the room. And they do this really over the top reaction where the whole club kind of stops and makes fun of her. And this could be really kind of like corny and saccharine and not, but I think that they walk a really fine line here and do it well. Yes.
Yeah.
With this moment where Elphaba sort of defiantly decides she's not going to let them make fun of her. And she does this weird dance and everyone's laughing at her while she does this weird dance. And they really slow the movie down here. And it's this moment where Galinda realizes what she's done, and she feels
Elphaba actually, Galinda was nice to her sister, or like she got a boy to ask her sister to the dance. So her sister tells Elphaba, you need to be nice to Galinda. So Elphaba gets Galinda into the course with Maribel. And so then Galinda realizes like, wow, I really just did something wrong. And this, I agree with you, like this sequence is when their relationship turns.
Right.
And they go from being enemies to being best friends. And it's really, really worked for me.
And this is something in musicals that you can do, is you can do a lot with like dance or with without speaking, with a single line in a song, or with, and especially in movie musicals, with a look or something. The fact that this moment, this transition from them being enemies to best friends, happens in this unspoken dance, the performance from both actors is really moving, especially Cynthia Erivo here.
Oh yeah, this she's putting on a strong face, but she's crying.
And when Ariana Grande looks at her and says, it's okay, and says, like, you're okay. Like, you know, and like, it was really moving, really, really moving.
Yeah.
And, very well done. And this is a moment that you couldn't do on stage. You can't slow it down like that. Also, there's some fun, you know, about like the behind the scenes drama with her and the guy that plays Bach,
guy. I don't know that.
That guy is a Broadway actor who plays Ethan. What's his name? Ethan. But he and Ariana Grande Ethan Slater. They started dating during the movie, and he was like married, and he just had a baby with his wife, and he left his wife for Ariana Grande. And again, this is so musical theater coded, like people getting into showmances and falling in love because they call it a showmance. Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah. So
that's interesting. Very interesting.
Anyway, that's a little behind the scenes drama for you. So now there is a budding friendship between our two leads, and we obviously go to another very popular number, And this was great. This was, some people said that they felt like the execution of this was a little underwhelming, but it's like, have you ever seen the stage musical? It's just, it takes place in Glinda's room. That's the number.
I mean, it could have been more over the top, but it didn't bother me that it wasn't. I agree. It was good. I enjoyed it.
I like that it's just a moment between the two of them, because again, this is, if it went out into the whole school and it was them dancing, it's about them. It's about the relationship that we're building.
I agree.
Anyway, now at this point, you know, the two of them are friends. There's also this moment where something happens between Elphaba and Fiero that sets up.
So that they get rid of Dr. The goat. I am butchering names right now.
Dillamond.
Thank you.
Yep.
He's not there anymore. Actually, they forcibly take him out, and then they bring in the new teacher, and he has an animal in a cage, which is a new invention. So nobody's ever seen a cage before. And then Elphaba does this, you know, she uses her magic and kind of puts everybody to sleep with these poppies, I guess, except for Fiero. And then they save the animal. They take him out, and they have a moment. Like, Fiero and Galinda, like, do actually fall in love. And I actually think they did that really well, is that they show that, like, Fiero does actually like Galinda.
Yeah.
He may not love her, but he likes her.
Yeah.
And but then in this moment, they save the animal, they go away, and you can tell that Elphaba and Fiero are starting to have feelings for each other.
Yeah.
And this was played really well. I think Fiero is really drawn to Elphaba because she kind of is what he wants to be, which is not letting anybody get to her. You know, she's kind of her own woman. He wants to be his own man type thing. So, but they have that relationship, and it's kind of like they're both kind of scared of that happening. Now, this will come back way more in part two, yeah. But I think they handled it really well. Since I know that it worked for me, and I thought they did it really.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the unresolved story threads of part one is this love triangle that's sort of been set up between these friends. And you can obviously imagine how that could maybe drive a wedge between them as the story progresses. But anyway, let's get ahead to Elphaba getting, you know, Madame Mirabel is doing some conspiring, and she winds up getting an invitation to the Emerald City.
Yeah.
And they go off to the Emerald City in this amazing train that they really built.
They did. Wow. That's beautiful.
A real train that they built for there are so many amazing.
It was awesome. Yeah.
And they go off to the Emerald City, and it's just supposed to be Elphaba, but she invites her friend Glinda with her. And they go off, and this is a fantastic sequence. This sequence
I loved it.
Is fantastic. We get cameos from Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth here, which I expected. I expected at some point to see those two. I didn't know in what capacity, and I thought that they were well used. I thought
I agree.
And this is a new piece of music, I believe. I don't think that this is actually.
Yeah, I don't know. Either they extended one that was already there, probably new. So that
the
they
song
them in there.
"One Short Day," I believe, is that's from the musical. But this little show that they do about I don't think that's from the stage music. I could be wrong.
You're probably right. But
I think they added that so that they could do these little cameos, and I didn't mind it at all. It's lovely, and this whole sequence is great. And they go up to meet the wizard. There's this amazing, again, practical giant face of Jeff Goldblum, this puppet face. And this is real. They could have very easily done this with CGI. And I think a lot of 21st century productions would opt to do an effect like that with CGI. Yeah. And they don't. They have a big, practical, giant Jeff Goldblum wooden face. And it's really cool. And we know the story of the wizard because it's in The Wizard of Oz. Like, he's just a guy who hides behind tricks and smoke and mirrors. And he's a magician. He's not a sorcerer. He's a showman. And he's also, a guy from our world.
Yeah. It's funny, in every iteration of Wizard of Oz, the Wizard of Oz is a fraud. No matter what, like, sometimes he's the good guy, but ultimately he's always a fraud, and he's a fraud in this one as well.
Did you ever see Oz the Great and Powerful with
I did.
Do they try to give him some kind of redemption in that movie, or is he also just like a shyster in that movie?
They do. I mean, he's more of the good guy in it, but he's also, it's like he uses his illusions to help everybody. That was a movie that had such potential that I didn't think was great, but he's just a trickster, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and Jeff Goldblum here, you know, I think he does what he needs to do. I don't think that, and some people are going like, he's fine. And I'm like, I think, look, like, who else are you going to get to do it? He's the right guy to cast. And he does, I think his singing is nice. I think that he does a nice job with it. I like this little model that he's got built with the LED like light up to change the road to say, I like him introducing this concept of, I want this road that all roads lead back to Oz, you know? Mm-hmm. And Glinda being the person who sort of says, I think yellow is the right touch. Cause that's sort of Glinda's wheelhouse, is to know kind of what looks good with what, you know? And
Yeah. I thought that was cool too. I liked that touch. And this, again, this is the part where it kind of moves quickly because she meets the wizard and she loves it. I mean, the whole thing with the song at the very beginning of what she wants, her want, the thing that Elphaba wants is for the wizard to change her from being green.
Right.
And we didn't really talk about that. She thinks that the wizard can cure her of her being green. And when she gets there, you know, throughout the whole movie, her desire has changed from wanting to become not green to wanting to save the animals. Yeah. So she kind of like, you know, she basically says like, oh, I want to save all the animals. And through the, you know, through the next few events, they realize that the wizard is the one who's actually been creating all this hate towards all the animals. They need to give somebody a really good villain, and the animals are kind of who he's going after.
Yeah, and I'm sure that this is fleshed out better in the book, but neither in the stage musical or in the film adaptation do we get a really good idea of like why the animals. And for if I'm just to use the stage musical and this version without reading the book, I guess I could say, since he's a guy from Earth, from our world, yes, maybe he's used to animals being just, yeah, you know, he figures, what's the difference? I'll just make it more like where I'm from.
Yeah.
But it feels like if you were in a world where animals could speak and you could see that they were intelligent beings with personalities, yeah, and that wore clothes and like, and it would be weird, but to get all xenophobic and like, and Hitler-y on them. But
yeah,
I imagine in the book, there's more of a reason why he decides to target the animals, or maybe it's just that he needs to scapegoat somebody.
Yeah.
And who better to scapegoat than actual goats and other,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. Yeah. And that's, yeah, I totally agree. And that seems like maybe that is the answer. And also the fact that he's not a wizard, so he needs to kind of keep the attention off of himself. So that, yeah, could possibly be it too, right? Yeah. He's looking for something. He's
right.
He's holding, grasping at straws, really.
And I just realized that favor too, that the person who wrote the book probably made Dr. Dillamond a goat because they're doing a reference to scapegoating.
Yeah. Yeah. That would make sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, they have, she really, Elphaba really figures out pretty quick that the wizard is not magic, because they have the book of spells, and Elphaba immediately opens it and reads it and creates all the flying monkeys that, mm-hmm, we see. And she feels horrible for it. So she wants to take it back, and they say they can't. And then she realizes the wizard has no power. That, yeah, just a human.
They're using her because she's the only person with actual enough power to, yes, use the Grimmery, the book of spells. Yes. I will say this, from the book that I have not read, but my a friend of mine who has, I heard a detail that was, I thought was really interesting, and it would be cool if they could figure out a way to incorporate this, but I don't know if they will. Mm-hmm. It feels like they do a departure in the stage musical where the words in the Grimmery are this weird other magical language. But, mm-hmm, I guess a detail in the book is that the wizard is the only one who can read it until Elphaba comes along. But the reason why the wizard can read it and no one else can is that the Grimmery is written in English. It's written in the language from where he comes from. And, yes, no one in Oz can read that language. And I, yeah, wonder if they'll let us know that somehow in the second movie, that Elphaba can read English because she's the daughter of the, right, wizard.
The wizard, which, yeah.
Yeah. And
spoiler for part two.
Spoiler for, you know, the guy that basically, you know, gave, yeah, her mom a roofie and impregnated, yeah, her mom is the wizard.
Yeah.
But I wonder if we'll get into that. I don't know. But I think that's an interesting detail that this book
is interesting. Yeah. It'd be really cool if they had, yeah, they had a different alphabet, right? So Oz, right, has, they speak English, but they have a different alphabet, whatever. Right. That would be great if they went into that. That would actually be really cool. But then again, she's speaking this weird language, which is definitely not English. So, but anyway.
At least the way it's presented, it's kind of like, you know, when you're watching, like, we're going to talk about Gladiator next. They're not, yeah, speaking English in ancient Rome,
no,
but in the movie, no, it's presented to, yeah, us as though everyone is speaking English. And I think that they could do a similar thing here where it's like, yes, all these characters are speaking English because this is an English speaking movie, but in Oz, they're actually, yeah, speaking Aussie, some other Aussie-in. And this language sounds different when she reads it, but what it actually is,
yeah, you could say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. English from, yeah, wherever Oz is from, you know, Earth, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, she realizes this. She decides, okay, I need to kind of go out on my own because I'm the only person with actual power and I need to help the animals. And that Oz and Madame Mirabelle kind of quickly turn on her, like,
very
immediately
quickly,
are just like, we're gonna paint her as a villain. And they sort of, like you said, they try to entice Glinda to get to their side. She and Glinda sort of escape together in a really thrilling sequence here. I,
yeah,
like this when they're,
yeah,
crossing the bridge and the monkeys are slamming into the windows,
yeah,
and all this stuff. Again, everything that they can add to make it more cinematic and heightened. And we get to the finale, you know, defying gravity, where she goes into this this room, and she's looking up a levitation spell.
Yeah.
And it winds up making this broom levitate. But man, the execution of this is another moment where they're really changing the pacing of the stage show, and they're taking moments to slow things down or to extend things in the arrangement of the song, particularly when she starts to fly, when she actually goes and they extend the song out to, you know, and I think that initially a lot of people who are huge super fans of the musical are going to go, oh no, don't change the song. This is the best song in the musical. But it's right for the movie, especially for the climax of the film, to take these beats, to draw it out so that when she finally does her big finale, it just hits with so much more force. There's something that Cynthia Erivo does here vocally that gives me chills. And it's that she sings The Wizard and I earlier on in the film, and that's probably the most she belts up to this point in the movie. But everything that she's singing is being sung in a really kind of pure register. She's singing in a more youthful, naive space, and not really unleashing the full power of her voice. And the fact that Cynthia Erivo doesn't really let us hear a guttural kind of growl and powerful, like the true power of her singing voice, until that very last note.
Yeah.
When she comes down and her giant cape is flapping in the wind, and she does
maybe
one of the most famous notes in the history of musical theater. And she it's like from her guts.
Yeah.
It knocked me out.
Yeah. I mean, it really, like, they saved everything for that moment, and it was building. And the fact that, like, everyone knew it was coming. Everyone knows that song. I mean, almost everybody knows that song. And the fact that they did have these pieces in the middle to kind of, like, so that it doesn't draw out so much at the end, it kind of plays out a little bit more. And then the ending is really her last note that she gives. And, you know, it really does expand. It works so much more. It works so much better for this as a movie, just like you said. And then when she does it, like, that's pretty much the end of the movie. Like, she does it, and it's like she flies off. And I love that she is flying, because it makes you feel like you get that she can fly now. Like, she's flying, and the monkeys are following her, and like everything, like it's so much more grand than the musical. I mean, you can only do so much on a stage, you know, and they do as well as you can. But this, they really, like, okay, this is what it should be like.
And Stephen Schwartz has always said this, that last note is her battle cry. That's her announcing to the wizard and to all these people that she's going to lead a rebellion against what's happening in Oz. And that last note is a battle cry. Not knowing that, and the way it's staged, you could easily just mistake it as it's just a big, powerful note to end act one of a musical. And I never personally, growing up, saw it as a battle cry. I never interpreted it that way.
Yeah.
And then watching this movie, it was the first time ever, especially that she's looking at kind of the army of the Wizard of Oz, and she's above them, flying above them. And when she does it there, it does sound like this guttural, tribal declaration of war. It's like the way that she does it feels like it's on. Like, we are, you know, we are now at odds.
Yeah,
you know, you and me.
Yeah, and she's making a statement, and then totally. Mm-hmm. And I never thought of that battle cry. That's actually very, very fitting.
Yeah, and I think that he always wanted it to be that, and I'm sure all of the actors that have ever played Elphaba intended it. They were trying to get into that, but it also is like, it's become this thing of just like, how are you singing it? What kind of riff are you doing? What kind of run? What are you doing to play with the notes?
Yeah.
Instead of what Cynthia Erivo does, which is she has her own take on the notes. It's not the exact run that Idina Menzel does, but it is, she like growls into it, and it's the only time in the movie that she uses that part of her voice. Mm-hmm. And it sounds vocally different than any other note she sings in the entire show. And the fact that she saves it for that very last moment and really makes it like Elphaba is yelling at them is awesome. It is really cool.
It's really great.
Okay, so that's Wicked part one. And
all right, should we do our scores?
Here we go. Let's rock and roll.
Yeah, dude, let's get him.
We do, if you're new to this podcast, we give scores out of 10. We give a technical rating. That's for everything, just how the movie was technically constructed, just the craft of the filmmaking, the cinematography, the acting, the score, the production design, all that stuff. We do a score for how they stuck the landing. How did the ending of the film work out? We do a score for rewatchability. We do a score for cultural significance and a score for subjectivity, our subjective preference of the film. What did you give this movie out of 10 on a technical scale?
I gave it an 8. I need to give it a 9, because I think my biggest problem, like I said, was the pacing was sometimes the end is a little too rushed and the beginning is a little too slow. More of a nitpick, but I think the costumes, the singing, the acting, everything is awesome. Those little nitpicks tick it down just one for me, but I think it was pretty, everyone's in top form.
I'm right where you are. I'm at 8.5 technically. And my docking just comes from my personal preference of, in some of those bigger production numbers, wanting to keep the camera wider for longer see more of it and see more of the beautiful production design that's going on, these sets. Yeah. And because I agree, there's such amazing work being done. And I just want to like really relish in it and see it more. And then I do agree that although I think that this movie is paced better than the stage version, maybe trading some of the, letting the end breathe a little bit, but also I don't know. I can see the argument being made that like, once you get to Emerald City, it's a freight train, that it's just all into the end.
Yeah.
I think that they did a fantastic job, but I took off a 1.5 for,
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair.
And, where are you at with the ending? How do you feel like they stuck the landing with Wicked Part 1?
I think, as we've talked about, I gave it a 10 because just this whole musical number, the fact that they made it so much more immersive than they could the stage play. And that's not a riff on the stage play. Just the fact that they used it very well.
Yeah.
I mean, they very well could have just made her levitate in that room, just like they did in the stage play, but it wouldn't be anywhere near as cinematic and engrossing. So the fact that they did that, they made her, fly, her note that she hits, it all worked. It all worked perfectly.
Yeah. It's a 10 out of 10. It's a fantastic, ending. It's like, that's the moment where you go, Defying Gravity is one of the most popular musical theater songs of the 21st century and one of the most, popular musical theater songs ever written.
Yeah.
And they pretty much knock it out of the park. And, with the effects, the staging of it and Cynthia Erivo's amazing performance of it.
Yeah.
It's a 10 out of 10. Rewatchability for Wicked.
I gave it an 8, mainly because it's long.
Mm-hmm.
It's long, but if you could rewatch this movie a lot, especially with the musical numbers and everything. So
there's definitely going to be a lot of details to look for on rewatch. Yes. And I feel like there's going to be a lot of things that I see that I maybe didn't notice the first time. I gave it an 8.5 because I love musicals, and this is a movie musical that really works, and I could really see myself revisiting and watching a lot.
Yeah.
Cultural significance for Wicked.
Yeah. I mean, I put it at an 8. We'll see it's probably higher, and it probably will be. I mean, it's making a ton of money.
Yeah.
For what it was. So I think the musical itself had a huge cultural impact, and the movie seems to be doing the same. So it might need to be more, but we'll see as time goes on.
Yeah. I gave it a 9. I think this movie could make $1 billion. Like it might.
It could. Yeah.
I'm realizing now with Wicked and Gladiator 2 being like the big movies that just came out, that like 2024, and with everything that we've been doing on this show, 2024 has been kind of an underwhelming year for films. Like all of the biggest films that everyone was looking forward to kind of underwhelmed. Beetlejuice, Twisters, all of these legacy sequels, and then Joker 2 just like really underwhelmed a lot of people. And I think that Megalopolis, like all of the big movies, didn't really perform. And so Wicked might wind up being the movie of the year. It might wind up winning Best Picture at the Academy.
Could.
From lack of competition, and I don't know that it should be a Best Picture winner, but it could just in a year where the competition is not very stiff. I gave it a 9 because, yeah, the cultural significance of this stage musical, the staying power that it's had on Broadway, yeah. and yeah. how well they did bringing this movie to life for the fans. I think it's gonna have a big echo.
Yeah.
Subjective score for Wicked.
I gave it an 8.5. Just for kind of some of the things, but I mean, man, this movie was great. I really, mm-hmm. really enjoyed this movie.
I gave it a 9. I'm just, I'm like, yeah. I'm really happy with it. I think, there's really nitpicky things that I could be a stickler on, but I'm like, why do that? It's great. Yeah. It's fantastic. Yeah. And that's it for me. Yeah. All right. Well, let us know what you thought of Wicked if you saw it, and let us know if you think that we're crazy or if you think that the color grading is off or
tell us what you think.
That the it should have been one movie. If you think it would have been better if they did a whole more hour of content after she does that note, you're wrong.
Don't even comment.
You're wrong. You
I mean, if you do feel that, tell us how it should have been, cuz if I were to make this one movie, it would have to be 2 hours and 40 minutes as a whole, not 3 hours and 40 minutes. So anyway, but if you feel like you would know how to make it better, let us know. But I agree. I think it should be two parts.
Yeah,
it makes more sense than The Hobbit for sure.
And I am interested to see how, because like when I think about Act Two, like the only big song is No Good Deed Goes Unpunished and Just for This Moment. Those are like the two big song, and I'm like, can they sustain an entire movie on two kind of blockbuster songs? I don't know. We'll see. Because the first act has all of the songs. Like
it does.
The Wizard and I, you know, What Is This Feeling? Popular, Defying Gravity. They're all in the first act. And so we'll see how they truly stick the landing with part two. But for part one, it's a banger. They killed it.
Yep, they did.
All right, well, go check out our review for Gladiator 2, which we're going to do next, and we'll see you at the next one. Okay.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.